over a gun, knowing that their kid is potentially dangerous. But look, I want to just sort of speak as a father of three beautiful little kids, and our oldest is now in second grade. And like a lot of parents, we send our kids to school with such hope and such joy and such pride at their little faces on the first day of school. And we know, unfortunately, that a lot of kids are going to experience this terrible epidemic of gun violence. And of course, our hearts go out to the families that are affected by this terrible stuff. And we do have to do better. And I think that Governor Walz and I actually probably agree that we need to do better on this. The question is just, how do we actually do it? Now, here's something that really bothers me and worries me about this epidemic of violence. The gross majority, close to 90% in some of the statistics I've seen, of the gun violence in this country is committed with illegally obtained firearms. And while we're on that topic, we know that thanks to Kamala Harris's open border, we've seen a massive influx in the number of illegal guns run by the Mexican drug cartels. So that number, the amount of illegal guns in our country is higher today than it was 3.5 years ago. But what do we do about the schools? What do we do to protect our kids? And I think the answer is, and I say this not loving the answer, because I don't want my kids to go to school in a school that feels unsafe or where there are visible signs of security. But I unfortunately think that we have to increase security in our schools. We have to make the doors lock better. We have to make the doors stronger. We've got to make the windows stronger. And of course, we've got to increase school resource officers, because the idea that we can magically wave a wand and take guns out of the hands of bad guys, it just doesn't fit with recent experience. So we've got to make our schools safer. And I think we've got to have some common sense bipartisan solutions for how to do that.
Governor, you have 2 minutes.
Well, I think all the parents watching tonight, this is your biggest nightmare. Look, I got a 17-year-old and he witnessed a shooting at a community center playing volleyball. Those awful things don't leave you. As a member of Congress, I sat in my office surrounded by dozens of the Sandy Hook parents, and they were looking at my 7-year-old picture on the wall. Their 7-year-old were dead, and they were asking us to do something. And look, I'm a hunter. I own firearms. The vice president is. We understand that the Second Amendment is there, but our first responsibility is to our kids to figure this out. In Minnesota, we've enacted enhanced red flag laws, enhanced background checks, and we can start to get data. But here's the problem. If we really want to solve this, we've got folks that won't allow research to be even done on gun violence. And this idea that we should just live with it, and I here's what I do think, that this is a good start to the conversation. I 100% believe that Senator Vance hates it when these kids, it's abhorrent and it breaks your heart. I agree with that. But that's not far enough when we know there are things that worked. I've spent time in Finland and seen some Finnish schools. They don't have this happen, even though they have a high gun ownership rate in the country. There are reasonable things that we can do to make a difference. It's not infringing on your Second Amendment. And the idea to have some of these weapons out there, it just doesn't make any sense. Kamala Harris, as an attorney general, worked on this issue. She knows that it's there. No one's trying to scaremonger and say, we're taking your guns, but I ask all of you out there, do you want your schools hardened to look like a fort? Is that what we have to go? When we know there's countries around the world that their children aren't practicing these types of drills. They're being kids. We owe it to them to get a fix. These are things that shouldn't be that difficult. You can still keep your firearms, and we can make a difference. We have to. If you're listening tonight, this breaks your heart.
Senator.
Tim, first of all, I didn't know that your 17-year-old witnessed a shooting. And I'm sorry about that, and I hope
appreciate
that he's doing okay.
So.
Christ have mercy. It is awful. And I appreciate what Tim said, actually, about Finland, because I do think it illustrates some of the frankly, weird differences between our own country's gun violence problem and Finland is, okay, first of all, we have way higher rates of mental health abuse or mental health substance abuse. We have way higher rates of depression, way higher rates of anxiety. We unfortunately have a mental health crisis in this country that I really do think that we need to get to the root causes of, because I don't think it's the whole reason why we have such a bad gun violence problem, but I do think it's a big piece of it. Another driver of the gun violence epidemic, especially that affecting our kids, it doesn't earn as many headlines, but is the terrible gun violence problem in a lot of our big cities. And this is why we have to empower law enforcement to arrest the bad guys, put them away, and take gun offenders off the streets. I think there's a whole host of things that we can do here, but I do think at our schools, we've got to talk about more security.
Senator, thank you. Governor, you previously opposed an assault weapons ban, but it only later in your political career did you change your position. Why?
Yeah, I sat in that office with those Sandy Hook parents. I've become friends with school shooters. I've seen it. Look, the NRA, I was an NRA guy for a long time. They used to teach gun safety. I'm of an age where my shotgun was in my car so I could pheasant hunt after football practice. That's not where we live today. And several things I want to mention on this is, talking about cities and where it's at, the number one, where the most firearm deaths happen in Minnesota are rural suicides. And we have an epidemic of children getting guns and shooting themselves. And so we have, and we should look at all of the issues. Making sure folks have health care and all that, but I want to be very careful. This idea of stigmatizing mental health, just because you have a mental health issue doesn't mean you're violent. And I think what we end up doing is we start looking for a scapegoat. Sometimes it just is the guns. It's just the guns, and there are things that you can do about it. But I do think that this is one, and I think this is a healthy conversation. I think there's a capacity to find solutions on this that work, protect Second Amendment, protect our children. That's our priority.
Gentlemen, thank you. Margaret?
Thank you, Nora. Let's turn now to the top contributor to inflation, the high cost of housing and rent. There's a shortage of more than 4 million homes in the United States, and that contributes to the high housing prices. Governor Walz, the Harris campaign promises a $25,000 down payment assistance for first-time home buyers and a $10,000 tax credit. They also promise to build 3 million new homes. Where are you building these homes, and won't handing out that kind of money just drive up prices higher?
No, it's not handing out. First, let me say this. This issue of housing, and I think those of you listening on this, the problem we've had is that we've got a lot of folks that see housing as another commodity. It can be bought up, it can be shifted, it can be moved around. Those are not folks living in those houses. Those of you listening tonight, that house is a big deal. I bought and owned one house in my life. My mom still lives in the house where I was. And when I think of a house, I'm thinking of Christmas services after midnight mass where you go with your family. We need to make it more affordable. And one of the things, as I said, this program that the vice president is pushing forward and bringing a new way of approaching this is something we're doing in Minnesota from that lead. We in the state invested in making sure our housing was the biggest investment that we'd ever made in housing. It starts to make it easier. We cut some of the red tape. Local folks, look, we can't do it at the federal level, but local folks make it easier to build those homes. And then that down payment assistance. I can tell all of you out there, one of the, certainly for me, using the GI Bill was one thing, but a veteran's home loan, the big thing about a veteran's home loan is you don't have to pay the down payment. Those are things that make it there. Now, look, you're going to pay it back, and you're going to pay your mortgage. Those are things that we know in the long run, the appreciated value, the generational wealth that's created from it. And I will give Minneapolis an example. Minneapolis is the one city where we've seen the lowest inflation rates. We've seen a 12% increase in stock because we put some of these things in, and we're implementing a state program to make sure we give some of that down payment assistance. We get it back from people because here's what we know. People with stable housing end up with stable jobs. People with stable housing have their kids able to get to school. All of those things in the long run end up saving our money. And that's the thing that I think we should be able to find some common ground in, but we can't blame immigrants for the only reason. That's not the case that's happening in many cities. The fact of the matter is that we don't have enough naturally affordable housing, but we can make sure that the government's there to help kickstart it, create that base.
Governor, your time is up. Senator Vance, as far as your campaign's position, the promise is to seize federal lands to build homes, remove regulation, provide tax breaks, and cut back on immigration, which you say pushes up prices. Where are you going to build all the new homes you're promising, and what part of any of this plan will provide immediate relief? You have 2 minutes.
Well, first of all, Tim just said something that I agree with. We don't want to blame immigrants for higher housing prices, but we do want to blame Kamala Harris for letting in millions of illegal aliens into this country, which does drive up costs, Tim. 25 million illegal aliens competing with Americans for scarce homes is one of the most significant drivers of home prices in the country. It's why we have massive increases in home prices that have happened right alongside massive increases in illegal aliens. alien populations under Kamala Harris's leadership. Now, Tim just mentioned a bunch of ideas. Now, some of those ideas I actually think are halfway decent, and some of them I disagree with. But the most important thing here is Kamala Harris is not running as a newcomer to politics. She is the sitting vice president. If she wants to enact all of these policies to make housing more affordable, I invite her to use the office that the American people already gave her, not sit around and campaign and do nothing while Americans find the American dream of homeownership completely unaffordable. Now, you asked, Margaret, what would immediately change the equation for American citizens? If you lower energy prices, as Donald Trump says, drill, baby, drill, one of the biggest drivers of housing costs aside from illegal immigration is, think about it. If a truck driver is paying 40% more for diesel, then the lumber he's delivering to the job site to build the house is also going to become a lot more expensive. If we open up American energy, you will get immediate pricing relief for American citizens, not, by the way, just in housing, but in a whole host of other economic goods, too.
Senator Vance, you still have 23 seconds there. Do you want to answer?
Can I have it?
Where? Yeah. Governor, we will get to you in a moment. But, Senator, where are you going to seize the federal lands? Can you clarify?
Well, what Donald Trump has said is we have a lot of federal lands that aren't being used for anything. They're not being used for a national park. They're not being used, and they could be places where we build a lot of housing. And I do think that we should be opening up building in this country. We have a lot of land that could be used. We have a lot of Americans that need homes. We should be kicking out illegal immigrants who are competing for those homes, and we should be building more homes for the American citizens who deserve to be here.
Senator, your time is up. Governor, I do want to let you respond to the allegation that the vice president is letting in migrants.
Well, of course, that's not true. And again, you have the facts. I guess we agreed not to fact check. I'll check it. That, look, crossings are down compared to when Donald Trump left office. But it's, again, blaming and not trying to find the solution. I was going to ask, though, on this question, are we going to drill and build houses in the same federal land? And I think when people hear federal lands, these are really important pieces of land. Now, Minnesota doesn't have a lot of federal lands. I know in the western part of the countries we do. There's not a lot of federal lands in and around Minneapolis, for example. So the issue is I don't understand the federal lands issue unless we see this, and I worry about this as someone who cares deeply about our national parks and our federal lands. Look, Minnesota, we protect these things. We've got about 20% of the world's fresh water. These lands protect. They're there for a reason. They belong to all of us. But again, this is when you view housing and you view these things as commodities. Like, there's a chance to make money here. Let's take this federal land and let's sell it to people for that. I think there's better ways to do this. We've seen it in Minnesota. We're able to refurbish some of these houses. We're able to make some investments. That gets people in. And I'm still on the fact on this. Economists, Senator Vance, you said you don't like the economists. Which economists are saying that it is immigrants that's adding to the cost?
Governor, your time is up. But Senator, on that point, I'd like for you to clarify. There are many contributing factors to high housing costs. What evidence do you have that migrants are part of this problem?
Well, there's a Federal Reserve study that we're happy to share after the debate. We'll put it up on social media, actually, that really drills down on the connection between increased levels of migration, especially illegal immigration, and higher housing prices. Now, of course, Margaret, that's not the entire driver of higher housing prices. It's also the regulatory regime of Kamala Harris. Look, we are a country of builders. We're a country of doers. We're a country of explorers. But we increasingly have a federal administration that makes it harder to develop our resources, makes it harder to build things, and wants to throw people in jail for not doing everything exactly as Kamala Harris says they have to do. And what that means is that you have a lot of people who would love to build homes who aren't able to build homes. I actually agree with Tim Walz. We should get out of this idea of housing as a commodity. But the thing that has most turned housing into a commodity is giving it away to millions upon millions of people who have no legal right to be here.
What are the federal regulations? I deal with this as a governor.
You can very quickly reply.
I'm sorry. I get this as a governor, and I don't necessarily disagree with that, that in some cases, many of those are local, many of them are state. I don't know which ones are federal, but I think whenever we talk regulations, people think they can get rid of them. I think you want to be able to get out of your house in a fire. I think you want to make sure that it's fireproof and those types of things. So which are the regulations? Because the vice president's not responsible for those. Congress writes those.
Governor, thank you. Gentlemen, we have a lot to get to. You're passionate about the housing crisis, I can tell. But Nora?
Thank you. One of the top problems facing Americans is the high cost of health care. Senator Vance, At the last presidential debate, former President Trump was asked about replacing the Affordable Care Act. In response, he said, "I have concepts of a plan." Since then, Senator, you've talked about changing how chronically ill Americans get health insurance. Can you explain how that would work? And can you guarantee that Americans with pre-existing conditions won't pay more? I'll give you 2 minutes.
Well, of course, we're going to cover Americans with pre-existing conditions. In fact, a lot of my family members have gotten health care. I believe, you know, members of my family actually got private health insurance, at least for the first time, switched off of Medicaid onto private insurance for the first time under Donald Trump's leadership. And I think that, you know, a lot of people have criticized this concepts of a plan remark. Look, it's very simple common sense. I think as Tim Walz knows from 12 years in Congress, you're not going to propose a 900-page bill standing on a debate stage. It would bore everybody to tears, and it wouldn't actually mean anything because part of this is the give and take of bipartisan negotiation. Now, when Donald Trump was actually president, and again, he has a record to be proud of, prescription drugs fell in 2018 for the first time in a very long time. Under Kamala Harris's leadership, prescription drugs are up about 7%. Under Donald Trump's entire 4 years, they were up about 1.5%. He introduced pricing transparency. Think about health care. You go into a hospital, you try to buy something, and nobody knows what it actually costs. That price transparency will actually give American consumers a little bit more choice and will also drive down costs. And we talked about, you know, the reinsurance regulations is what I was talking about. Look, Donald Trump has said that if we allow states to experiment a little bit on how to cover both the chronically ill but the non-chronically ill, it's not just a plan. He actually implemented some of these regulations when he was president of the United States. And I think you can make a really good argument that it salvaged Obamacare, which was doing disastrously until Donald Trump came along. And I think this is an important point about President Trump. Of course, you don't have to agree with everything that President Trump has ever said or ever done. But when Obamacare was crushing under the weight of its own regulatory burden and health care costs, Donald Trump could have destroyed the program. Instead, he worked in a bipartisan way to ensure that Americans had access to affordable care. It's not perfect, of course, and there's so much more that we can do, but I think that Donald Trump has earned the right to put in place some better health care policies. He's earned it because he did it successfully the first time.
Governor?
All right, here's where being an old guy gives you some history. I was there at the creation of the ACA, and the reason it was so important is I come from a major health care state, home of the Mayo Clinic, home to Medical Alley, 3M, Medtronic, all of those. We understand healthcare. It's why we're ranked first on affordability and accessibility and quality of healthcare. And so what I know is under Kamala Harris, more people are covered than they have before. And those of you listening, this is critical to you. Now, Donald Trump all of a sudden wants to go back and remember this. He ran on the first thing he was going to do on day one was to repeal Obamacare. On day one, he tried to sign an executive order to repeal the ACA. He signed on to a lawsuit to repeal the ACA, but lost at the Supreme Court. And he would have repealed the ACA had it not been for the courage of John McCain to save that bill. Now, fast forward, what that means to you is you lose your pre-existing conditions. If you're sitting at home and you got asthma, too bad. If you're a woman, probably not. Broke your foot during football, might kick you out. Your kids get kicked out when they're 26. Kamala Harris negotiated drug prices for the first time with Medicare. We have 10 drugs that will come online, the most common ones that will be there. But look, this issue, and when Donald Trump said, "I've got a concept of a plan," it cracked me up as a fourth grade teacher because my kids would have never given me that. But what Senator Vance just explained might be worse than a concept, because what he explained is pre-Obamacare. And I'll make this as simple as possible because I have done this for a long time. What they're saying is, if you're healthy, why should you be paying more? So what they're going to do is let insurance companies pick who they insure, because guess what happens? You pay your premium, it's not much. They figure they're not going to have to pay out to you. But those of you a little older, gray, you know, got cancer, you're going to get kicked out of it. That's why the system didn't work. Kamala Harris will protect and enhance the ACA.
Governor, thank you. Senator, you have not yet explained how you would protect people with pre-existing conditions or laid out that plan.
Well, look, we currently have laws and regulations in place right now that protect people with pre-existing conditions. We want to keep those regulations in place, but we also want to make the health insurance marketplace function a little bit better. Now, what Governor Walz just said is actually not true. A lot of what happened and the reason that Obamacare was crushing under its own weight is that a lot of young and healthy people were leaving the exchanges. Donald Trump actually helped address that problem, and he did so in a way that preserved people's access to coverage who had pre-existing conditions. But again, something that these guys do is they make a lot of claims about if Donald Trump becomes president, all of these terrible consequences are going to ensue. But in reality, Donald Trump was president. Inflation was low. Take-home pay was higher. And he saved the very program from a Democratic administration that was collapsing and would have collapsed absent his leadership. He did his job, which is govern in a bipartisan way and get results, not just complain about problems, but actually solve them.
Governor, did enrollment under the Affordable Care Act go up under the Trump administration?
It's higher now that we've seen it go up. Look, people are using it. The system works. And the question about this of young people or whatever, that's the individual mandate piece of this. And Republicans fought tooth and nail saying, well, Americans should be free to do this. Well, then what happens
is— So you think the individual mandate's a good idea?
I think the idea of making sure the risk pool is broad enough to cover everyone, that's the only way insurance works. When it doesn't, it collapses. You are asking pre-ACA where we get people out. Look, people know that they need to be on health care. People expect it to be there. And when we are able to make it, and we are making it this way, when we incentivize people to be in the market, when we help people who might not be able to afford it get there, and we make sure then when you get sick and old, it's there for you. Because I heard people say, well, I don't want to buy into Medicare or whatever. Good luck buying health care once you get past 70. So look, the ACA works. We can continue to do better. Kamala Harris did that. The way she made everything better was negotiating those 10 drugs on Medicare for the first time in American history.
Thank you. Margaret.
Can I address that?
I apologize. We're out of time.
Ahead,
we have a number of subjects to discuss. Margaret.
Let's talk about families in America. There is a child care crisis in this country, and the United States is one of the very few developed countries in the world without a national paid leave program for new parents. Governor Walz, you've said that if Democrats win both the White House and Congress, this is a day one priority for you. How long should employers be required to pay workers while they are home taking care of their newborns? You have 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, that's negotiable, and that's what Congress worked. But here's what the deal is. Americans sitting out there right now, you may work for a big company. Look, we're home in Minnesota to some of the largest Fortune 500 companies. Kamala Harris knows that in California. Those companies provide paid family medical leave. One is, I think they're moral and they think it's a good thing, but it also keeps their employees healthy. We in Minnesota passed a paid family medical leave. You have a child, you. And I had to go back to work 5 days after my kids were born. This allows you to stay home a certain amount of time. What we know is that gets the child off to a better start, the family works better, we stay in their employers, we get more consistency in that. So Kamala Harris has made it a priority. We implemented it in Minnesota and we see growth. That's how you become a pro-business state. But the negotiations on it, and here's the issue. Those big companies are able to offer it. Those of you out there who don't have it, just imagine what happens if you get cancer or your child gets sick. We know what happens. You end up staying home. In some places, that means no paycheck because you've got no protection on that. This is the case of an economy that Donald Trump has set for the wealthiest amongst us. He's willing to give those tax breaks to the wealthiest. He's willing to say, bust those unions up, do whatever. What we're saying is the economy works best when it works for all of us. And so a paid family medical leave program, and I will tell you, go to the families or go to the businesses and ask them. As far as childcare on this, you have to take it at both the supply and the demand side. You can't expect the most important people in our lives to take either our children or our parents to get paid the least amount of money. And we have to make it easier for folks to be able to get into that business and then to make sure that folks are able to pay for that. We were able to do it in Minnesota, and I'm still telling you this. We were listed as the best state. We're still in crisis on this. A federal program of paid family and medical leave and help with this will enhance our workforce, enhance our families, and make it easier to have the children that you want.
Governor, your time is up. Senator, do you support a national paid leave program? And if so, for how long should employers be mandated to pay their employees while they are home taking care of their newborn? You have 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, first of all, Margaret, a number of my Republican colleagues and some Democrats, too, have worked on this issue. And I think there is a bipartisan solution here because a lot of us care about this issue. I mean, look, I speak from this very personally because I'm married to a beautiful woman who is an incredible mother to our three beautiful kids, but is also a very, very brilliant corporate litigator. And I'm so proud of her. But being a working mom, even for somebody with all of the advantages of my wife, is extraordinarily difficult. And it's not just difficult from a policy perspective. She actually had access to paid family leave because she worked for a bigger company. But the cultural pressure on young families, and especially young women, I think makes it really hard for people to choose the family model they want. A lot of young women would like to go back to work immediately. Some would like to spend a little time home with the kids. Some would like to spend longer at home with the kids. We should have a family care model that makes choice possible. And I think this is a very important substantive difference between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris's approach. I mean, look, if you look at the federal programs that we have that support paid family leave right now, the Community Development Block Grant, and there's another block grant program that spends a lot of money from the federal government. These programs only go to one kind of child care model. Let's say you'd like your church maybe to help you out with child care. Maybe you live in a rural area or an urban area and you'd like to get together with families in your neighborhood to provide child care in the way that makes the most sense. You don't get access to any of these federal monies. We want to promote choice in how we deliver family care and how we promote child care because, look, it is unacceptable. And, you know, of course, Tim and I have been on the campaign trail a lot the past 7 or 8 weeks. And one of the biggest complaints I hear from young families is people who feel like they don't have options, like they're choosing between going to work or taking care for their kids. That is an incredible burden to put on American families. We're the only country that does it. I think we could do a heck of a lot better.
Senator, thank you. You have also said, Senator Vance, many things about the American family. The Federal Reserve says parents will spend nearly as much on child care as they do on housing each month. So I want to get your thoughts on this. President Trump recently said, as much as child care is talked about as being expensive, it's, relatively speaking, not very expensive compared to the kinds of numbers we'll be taking in. Is President Trump committed to the $5,000 per child tax credit that you have described? You have 1 minute.
Well, what President Trump said, Margaret, I just want to defend my running mate here a little bit, is that we're going to be taking in a lot of money by penalizing companies for shipping jobs overseas and penalizing countries who employ slave laborers and then ship their products back into our country and undercut the wages of American workers. It's the heart of the Donald Trump economic plan. Cut taxes for American workers and American families. Cut taxes for businesses that are hiring and building companies in the United States of America, but penalize companies and countries that are shipping jobs overseas. That's the heart of the economic proposal. And I think what President Trump is saying is that when we bring in this additional revenue with higher economic growth, we're going to be able to provide paid family leave, child care options that are viable and workable for a lot of American families.
Can you clarify how that will solve the child care shortage?
Well, because as Tim said, a lot of the child care shortage is we just don't have enough resources going into the multiple people who could be providing family care options. And we're going to have to, unfortunately, look, we're going to have to spend more money. We're going to have to induce more people to want to provide child care options for American families, because the reason it's so expensive right now is because you've got way too few people providing this very essential service.
Thank you, Senator. Governor Walz, your ticket also has some child care tax credit proposals. Do you think Congress will agree to the $6,000 credit for newborns and $3,000 credit for children over the age of six, as your campaign has promised? Is that realistic?
Well, if these members of Congress are listening to anybody, I can tell you. And this is the biggest issue. Everybody listening tonight knows. I mean, I'm sure they were shocked to hear it's not that expensive. And let's be clear, whether it's $5,000 or $6,000, that plays you about 3 or 4 months. Let's be clear of where we're at on this. It's because we got out of an imbalance on this. We thought we were going to get by not paying people. I don't think Senator Vance or that and I are that far apart. I'm not opposed to what he's talking about on options. We've done scholarship types of things. I think we need to be open to making the case. But the issue here is, the question you asked is, you're not going to pay for it with these tariffs. That's just adding another $4,000 on the family and taking less. So not only do they not get the money to pay for that, they're $4,000 in the hole. That's Wharton School. That's his alma mater. And so I think the issue here is Those members of Congress, I can't believe they're not here. When I go to businesses, sure, they'll talk about taxes sometime, but they will lead with childcare and they will lead with housing, because we know the problem is, especially in a state like Minnesota, we need more workers because our economy's growing, but we need the workforce.
Governor, thank you. We need to move on. Nora?
Let's talk about the state of democracy, the top issue for Americans after the economy and inflation. After the 2020 election, President Trump's campaign and others filed 62 lawsuits contesting the results. Judges, including those appointed by President Trump and other Republican presidents, looked at the evidence and said there was no widespread fraud. The governors of every state in the nation, Republicans and Democrats, certified the 2020 election results and sent a legal slate of electors to Congress for January 6th. Senator Vance, you have said you would not have certified the last presidential election and would have asked the states to submit alternative electors. That has been called unconstitutional and illegal. Would you again seek to challenge this year's election results, even if every governor certifies the results? I'll give you 2 minutes.
Well, Nora, first of all, I think that we're focused on the future. We need to figure out how to solve the inflation crisis caused by Kamala Harris's policies, make housing affordable, make groceries affordable, and that's what we're focused on. But I want to answer your question because you did ask it. Look, what President Trump has said is that there were problems in 2020, and my own belief is that we should fight about those issues, debate those issues peacefully in the public square, and that's all I've said, and that's all that Donald Trump has said. Remember, he said that on January the 6th, the protesters ought to protest peacefully. And on January the 20th, what happened? Joe Biden became the president, Donald Trump left the White House, and now, of course, unfortunately, we have all of the negative policies that have come from the Harris-Biden administration. I believe that we actually do have a threat to democracy in this country, but unfortunately, it's not the threat to democracy that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz want to talk about. It is the threat of censorship. It's Americans casting aside lifelong friendships because of disagreements over politics. It's big technology companies silencing their fellow citizens. And it's Kamala Harris saying that rather than debate and persuade her fellow Americans, she'd like to censor people who engage in misinformation. I think that is a much bigger threat to democracy than anything that we've seen in this country in the last 4 years, in the last 40 years. Now, I'm really proud, especially given that I was raised by two lifelong blue-collar Democrats, to have the endorsement of Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard, lifelong leaders in the Democratic coalition. And of course, they don't agree with me and Donald Trump on every issue. We don't have to agree on every issue, but we're united behind a basic American First Amendment principle that we ought to debate our differences. We ought to argue about them. We ought to try to persuade our fellow Americans. Kamala Harris is engaged in censorship at an industrial scale. She did it during COVID. She's done it over a number of other issues. And that, to me, is a much bigger threat to democracy than what Donald Trump said when he said that protesters should peacefully protest on January the 6th.
Governor?
Well, I've enjoyed tonight's debate, and I think there was a lot of commonality here, and I'm sympathetic to misspeaking on things, and I think I might have with the senator.
Me too, man.
There's one, though, that this one is troubling to me, and I say that because I think we need to tell the story. Donald Trump refused to acknowledge this, and the fact is that I don't think we can be the frog in the pot and let the boiling water go up. He was very clear. I mean, he lost this election, and he said he didn't. 140 police officers were beaten at the Capitol that day, some with the American flag. Several later died, and it wasn't just in there. In Minnesota, a group gathered on the state Capitol grounds in St. Paul and said, "We're marching to the governor's residence, and there may be casualties." The only person there was my son and his dog, who was rushed out crying by state police. That issue and Mike Pence standing there as they were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." Mike Pence made the right decision. So, Senator, it was adjudicated over and over and over. I worked with kids long enough to know, and I said as a football coach, sometimes you really want to win, but the democracy is bigger than winning an election. You shake hands, and then you try and do everything you can to help the other side win. That's what was at stake here. Now, the thing I'm most concerned about is the idea that imprisoning your political opponents, already laying the groundwork for people not accepting this. And a president's words matter. A president's words matter. People hear that. So I think this issue of settling our differences at the ballot box, shaking hands when we lose, being honest about it, but to deny what happened on January 6th, the first time in American history that a president or anyone tried to overturn a fair election and the peaceful transfer of power. And here we are 4 years later in the same boat. I will tell you this, that when this is over, we need to shake hands this election, and the winner needs to be the winner. This has got to stop. It's tearing our country apart.
Margaret?
Senator Vance, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, well, look, Tim, first of all, it's really rich for Democratic leaders to say that Donald Trump is a unique threat to democracy when he peacefully gave over power on January the 20th, as we have done for 250 years in this country. We are going to shake hands after this debate and after this election. And of course, I hope that we win, and I think we're going to win. But if Tim Walz is the next vice president, he'll have my prayers, he'll have my best wishes, and he'll have my help whenever he wants it. But we have to remember that for years in this country, Democrats protested the results of elections. Hillary Clinton in 2016 said that Donald Trump had the election stolen by Vladimir Putin because the Russians bought like $500,000 worth of Facebook ads. This has been going on for a long time. And if we want to say that we need to respect the results of the election, I'm on board. But if we want to say, as Tim Walz is saying, that this is just a problem that Republicans have had, I don't buy that.
Governor.
January 6th was not Facebook ads. And I think a revisionist history on this. Look, I don't understand how we got to this point. But the issue was that happened. Donald Trump can do it. And all of us say there's no place for this. It has massive repercussions. This idea that there's censorship to stop people from doing, threatening to kill someone, threatening to do something, that's not censorship. Censorship is book banning. We've seen that. We've seen that brought up. I just think for everyone tonight, and I'm going to thank Senator Vance. I think this is the conversation they want to hear. And I think there's a lot of agreement, but this is one that we are miles apart on. This was a threat to our democracy in a way that we had not seen. And it manifested itself because of Donald Trump's inability to say. He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
It's a damning non-answer for you to not talk about censorship. Obviously, Donald Trump and I think that there were problems in 2020. We've talked about it. I'm happy to talk about it further. But you guys attack us for not believing in democracy. The most sacred right under the United States democracy is the First Amendment. You yourself have said there's no First Amendment right to misinformation. Kamala Harris wants to use the power of government and big tech to silence people from speaking their minds. That is a threat to democracy that will long outlive this present political moment. I would like Democrats and Republicans to both reject censorship. Let's persuade one another. Let's argue about ideas, and then let's come together afterwards.
You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. That's the test. That's the Supreme Court test.
Tim, fire in a crowded theater. You guys wanted to kick people off of Facebook for saying that toddlers shouldn't
wear
masks.
Senator, the governor does
have
the floor.
Fire in a crowded theater. That is criticizing the policies of the government, which is the right of every American.
Senator, the governor does have the floor for 1 minute to respond to you.
Yeah. Well, I don't run Facebook. What I do know is I see a candidate out there who refused. And now, again, and this I'm pretty shocked by this. He lost the election. This is not a debate. It's not anything anywhere other than in Donald Trump's world. Because look, when Mike Pence made that decision to certify that election, that's why Mike Pence isn't on this stage. What I'm concerned about is, where is the firewall with Donald Trump? Where is the firewall if he knows he could do anything, including taking an election, and his vice president's not going to stand to it? That's what we're asking you, America. Will you stand up? Will you keep your oath of office, even if the president doesn't? And I think Kamala Harris would agree. She wouldn't have picked me if she didn't think I would do that, because of course that's what we would do. So, America, I think you've got a really clear choice on this election of who's going to honor that democracy and who's going to honor Donald Trump.
Governor, your time is up. Thank you, gentlemen. We will be right back with both of our candidates. The CBS News vice presidential debate continues.
And you're listening to Civic Media coverage of the CBS presidential vice presidential debates. We'll be right back.
out here in the middle of all these acres, it can feel like you're the only person on earth. And sometimes that's how it feels when you're going through tough times. Trouble sleeping, your mind racing. So what do? We get help. There are people in our community who are here for us. Sometimes just talking to someone can make all the difference in the world. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
The Dom Salvia Show.
This mayor from Wausau, now at the center of a criminal investigation after he removed a drop box from City Hall before voters in Wausau could use it. Pat Kreitlow, what do you think of the mayor's explanation that he had a philosophical difference with the local election official?
Nobody cares. It's not your job. It's in the law. It's very clear. The municipal clerk makes the rules, not a politician.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
She is performing in Wisconsin early next month down in Baraboo. Charo, what is the secret? Is it the music? Is it the dancing? Are your shows what keep you young?
Yes, I will never get old while music is alive.
Yeah.
You got to move it, move it. I have ants in my pants. I had to move.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
"Hey, you got this. Just breathe." Hey, hey, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
The Todd Alba Show.
This narrative that the immigrants are coming to get you, that's fiction. Look at criminal charges in your community. And look how many of those people who have been there for years, if not decades, and how many of those people are new immigrants. And even a smaller percentage of how many are undocumented immigrants. It's not happening. It would be like going to places and say, "Well, you know what? I'm running for Congress to stop the zombies."
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
Congresswoman Summer Lee.
The American Stability Act doesn't just address the need for raising of the wage. The second thing is that tax reform piece, shifting the burden from the folks who are working class to the not just the 1%, the 0.01% of people who have seen so many benefits in this rigged system, and we have to start to unrig it.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Civic Media coverage of the vice presidential debate from CBS News in New York continues.
Welcome back to the CBS News vice presidential debate. It is now time for the closing statement. Senator Vance won the virtual coin toss and elected to go last. So, Governor Walz, you are first. You have 2 minutes.
Well, thank you, Senator Vance. Thank you to CBS News. And most importantly, thank you to all of you. If you're still up and the folks who missed Dancing with Our Stars, I appreciate it. But look, the support of the democracy matters. It matters that you're here. And I'm as surprised as anybody of this coalition that Kamala Harris has built, from Bernie Sanders to Dick Cheney to Taylor Swift, and a whole bunch of folks in between there. And they don't all agree on everything, but they are truly optimistic people. They believe in a positive future of this country and one where our politics can be better than it is. And I have to tell you, that better than it is the sense of optimism that there can be an opportunity economy that works for everyone, not just to get by, but to get ahead. And the idea that freedom really means something, Not the freedom of government to be in your bedroom or exam room, but the freedom for you to make choices about yourself. Now, look, we all know who Donald Trump is. He's told us, and as Maya Angelou said, believe him when he told you that. His first inaugural address talked about American carnage, and then he spent 4 years trying to maybe do that. Senator Vance tonight made it clear he will stand with Donald Trump's agenda. He will continue to push down that road. Excuse me. Kamala Harris gives us a different option. Now, I'll have to tell you, I'm going to be careful about the quotes, but there's one that Senator Vance said that does resonate with me. He said, Donald Trump makes the people I care about afraid. A lot of America feels that way. We don't need to be afraid. Franklin Roosevelt was right. All we have to fear is fear itself. Kamala Harris is bringing us a new way forward. She's bringing us a politics of joy. She's bringing real solutions for the middle class, and she's centering you at the heart of that. All the while asking everyone, join this movement, make your voices heard. Let's look for a new day where everybody gets that opportunity and everybody gets a chance to thrive. I humbly ask for your vote on November 5th for Kamala Harris.
Governor Walz, thank you. Senator Vance, your closing statement.
Well, I want to thank Governor Walz, you folks at CBS, and of course the American people for tuning in this evening. And one of the issues we didn't talk about was energy. And I remember when I was being raised by my grandmother, when she didn't have enough money to turn on the heat some nights because Ohio gets pretty cold at night and because money was often very tight. And I believe, as a person who wants to be your next vice president, that we are a rich and prosperous enough country where every American, whether they're rich or poor, ought to be able to turn on their heat in the middle of a cold winter night. That's gotten more difficult thanks to Kamala Harris's energy policies. I believe that whether you're rich or poor, you ought to be able to afford a nice meal for your family. That's gotten harder because of Kamala Harris's policies. I believe that whether you're rich or poor, you ought to be able to afford to buy a house. You ought to be able to live in safe neighborhoods. You ought to not have your communities flooded with fentanyl. And that, too, has gotten harder with Kamala because of Kamala Harris's policies. Now, I've been in politics long enough to do what Kamala Harris does when she stands before the American people and says that on day one, she's going to work on all these challenges I just listed. She's been the vice president for 3.5 years. Day one was 1,400 days ago, and her policies have made these problems worse. Now, I believe that we have the most beautiful country in the world. I meet people on the campaign trail who can't afford food, but have the grace and generosity to ask me how I'm doing and to tell me they're praying for my family. What that has taught me is that we have the greatest country, the most beautiful country, the most incredible people anywhere in the world. But they're not going to be able to achieve their full dreams with the broken leadership that we have in Washington. They're not going to be able to live their American dream if we do the same thing that we've been doing for the last 3.5 years. We need change. We need a new direction. We need a president who has already done this once before and did it well. Please vote for Donald Trump. And whether you vote for me or vote for Tim Walz, I just want to say I'm so proud to be doing this, and I'm rooting for you. God bless you, and good night.
Senator Vance, thank you. And thank you both for participating in the only vice presidential debate of this election cycle. I'm Margaret.
And there you have it, the vice presidential debate. Now we're joined by Pat Kreitlow, host of Up North News Radio, Dan Schaefer, political editor at Civic Media, and Angela Lang, community organizer. And I ask this question after each of these debates in one form or another, but put yourself in the mind of an undecided or open-minded voter. Did anything happen tonight that would really persuade you one way or the other? Dan Schaefer, we'll start with you.
Well, I just want to point to that final, one of those final questions on American democracy on January 6th. You know, we know that this is an issue that Republicans continue to lose on over and over again. We saw it in the 2022 midterms. We saw it over and over again, even here in Wisconsin, where some of the furthest right election denier candidates were losing over and over. And I think that is an issue that people are going to focus on. And I think Tim Walz made the point perfectly in that question, was saying that we can have these respectful exchanges about various policies throughout the course of the night. But that is a red line. That is something that, you know, people need to respect the results of an election. And, you know, like he's leaning into the Coach Walz type rhetoric, saying that we can shake hands at the end of this and move forward to make the country better. J.D. Vance could not bring himself to say that. So I think that is one of the issues that does stand out to me as one that, you know, it could move some swing voters at the end of the day.
Angela Lang, how about you? Was there anything that was said tonight that would, you know, persuade somebody who may be on the fence between these two campaigns?
Yeah, I don't know if it was anything that was said specifically, but I think it was the tone. For a minute, I was like, is this a boring debate for the regular American people? Because I think we're so used to so much chaos and all of that. But it felt very Midwest nice between the two candidates. It felt like there was an actual policy debate, whether people agree with it or not. And I think the everything really lies in the details. And although Vance is a lot more composed than Trump, when he was kind of called the question of answering some of the very tangible questions, he wasn't able to. Or if you're actually thinking about, like, this sounds good, but my critical thinking allows me to know that if he's talking about how censorship is so bad, why are they banning books about, you know, gender and sexuality and LGBT folks? And so it's one of those things where I think the tone and the demeanor wasn't quite as obvious as, say, the presidential debate. But I think it was something that once people actually sit and process and marinate on, then they understand that it kind of was like a gaslighting debate on the behalf of J.D. Vance. And, you know, I saw Dan kind of talk about this on Twitter, is that Vance was kind of painting a completely different picture of what people that actually felt and experienced of Donald Trump's presidency and his own legacy. And I'm very curious at the end of the day, kind of how Donald Trump actually views his running mate's performance, because there are so many times he was agreeing and it came across as, you know, we're more united than we are divided, but the devil was in the details. And if you actually sit and think about some of those answers, you realize the contradictions in and of themselves.
Pat Kreitlow, was there a moment tonight in your mind that either won it or lost it for either candidate?
No, I think it was very much like what Angela just described. I would describe it this way. Emotions versus ideas. A lot of what Tim Walz was talking about related to the ideas that Kamala Harris has put forward, that he would put forward, that Joe Biden had put forward previously. When J.D. Vance talked about some of the issues, it actually went more into emotions. If you're already predisposed to think that there are other people who are holding you back, that there are other people who are causing you problems, and that's why there's not enough housing out there, then, you know, then what you liked, what Donald Trump did, whatever it was, there wasn't really an outline of policy so much as a, if we make you think you're unhappy now, but you were happy during Trump, you're going to want to go back during that. Senator Vance did a good job of kind of, you know, putting, you know, some meat on the bones, or at least attempting to, but really it was more about, how do you feel? And if you don't feel great, well, then you're with us, because we can make you feel great again, as opposed to here's what we would actually do to solve these big challenges.
We talked about a couple of things before the show, and they did, in fact, come up during this. And Governor Walz was asked about what he said about where he was during the democracy protests in China. And he I would expect that he was prepared for that. He seemed a bit unprepared to answer the question off the cuff. Do you think that hurt him too badly?
No, I don't. I mm-hmm. think he said what he wanted to say all along was that he was a knucklehead and that he misspoke. The thing is, in a debate format like this, you're given 2 minutes. So what you saw him doing was saying, well, what can I do with the other minute 50 seconds to tell you about the circumstances around this? And he talked about his foreign travel and how if Donald Trump had done traveling like this, he would be doing things differently. He would be seeing the world differently. But as I said prior to the debate, yeah, it's a gotcha moment. And Tim Walz said, yep, you got me. I misspoke on that. But when you put that up against what's not exactly misspeaking, but in fact demonizing, you know, an entire race of people, I just don't think that this sits. There's nobody that says, well, I was going to vote for Tim Walz, but boy, that answer on Hong Kong just took me away. So I guess what I'm really saying is to the CBS moderators is that, was that really the best use of your time?
Well, let's talk about the moderator. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah. To go off of that point too, I think it just, you know, there's kind of an unbalanced equation here, because you have Walz kind of owning up to a certain level of making a mistake with some of those comments. But you had J.D. Vance on the other side when, you know, bringing up what happened in Springfield, Ohio, and he's doubling down on it and talking over the moderators and trying to correct what they're saying. And so, you know, we have Walls making a mistake. And I do think that was probably the weakest part for him of the debate tonight. But you also had instances on the other side with J.D. Vance, where he's talking over the moderators and going with a number of other just misleading falsehoods throughout the debate, you know, talking about whether or not he supported an abortion ban, talking about Donald Trump negotiating on health care and a plan that he was never able to deliver during his presidency, talking about bringing manufacturing back. We know that didn't happen. And we know that extremely well in Wisconsin because of the Foxconn debacle. So I think, you know, J.D. Vance's strategy in this debate seemed like, you know, going into it, saying basically pretending that the presidency of Donald Trump was something different than the one that we all experienced.
Angela Lang.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was interesting to me, and I agree that that was probably Walz's probably weakest moment. I don't think it was make or break, given all of the other challenges and all of the other issues that folks were talking about. But what was interesting is that, you know, Vance at one point, especially during the abortion question, said, "I want to protect innocent life and the vulnerable," which sounds good, but also clearly does not apply to other communities. This is a man that probably doesn't care about Black lives. This is a man that continues to try and limit protections of the LGBT community, that constantly refers to undocumented folks as illegal aliens, to the point where Wall says, when you don't want to solve something, you demonize it. And so I think it was interesting to be able to see the contradictions in his own logic. And I think that was like a bigger tell. I think that is something that folks are going to stick with, especially about how we continue to demonize folks. And I think some of the, not only the gaslighting, but some of the rhetoric and how we're talking about undocumented folks, especially when it comes to Haitians. And it was just interesting that it felt that Vance was not answering some of the point blank questions when asked. But if you really pay attention to the details, it was very clear his stances and the contradictions of himself.
Momentum seemed to swing for Walls when it came to the topic of reproductive rights. That's where he seemed to really sound confident and come up with some answers, and perhaps where the senator, not so much. It was my observational take on that. I was wondering how you felt about that. Anyone just jump in. That's okay.
Well, I would simply say that it was summed up very well by Tim Wall saying that there are just some things that you don't put up for a vote. You know, basic human rights, you know, the right to access health care. This should not be a checkerboard approach in this country to health rights.
Angela.
So I'm at a watch party here with this debate in Menominee Falls with Motherhood for Good. A lot of women in the audience here. And that the abortion question on that one got a pretty strong reaction in the room at the watch party here. So did his response, J.D. Vance's response on childcare. You know, Tim Walz in Minnesota, and I wrote about this in a piece at the Recombobulation Area Today, has really championed a lot of pro-family policies, investing in childcare, investing in paid family leave. And hearing the people in this room react to a completely out of touch comments from J.D. Vance on an issue like childcare was really a problem.
Well, out of touch, it seemed that this whole idea about manufacturing and tariffs would somehow make childcare more affordable for folks. That didn't really seem to land.
No, he's been trying to do that, that tariffs are the answers to everything. We need to solve health care. Let's have tariffs. We need to solve child care. Let's pass tariffs. Trump has said repeatedly, we're going to be awash in cash. And that gets to one of my main points with the debate. Vance kept saying, well, Kamala Harris was vice president these past 3 years. Well, yeah. And Donald Trump was president for the 4 years prior. So we have his record as well, including tariffs, how the $28 billion he had to make in payments to farmers, how much it hurt Wisconsin farmers, you know, finding global markets. So we know his record already as well. So we can compare these things on an even keel and see that tariffs aren't going to solve the child care crisis. And, you know, the folks at Motherhood for Good were quite right to scoff at that.
Angela Lang.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things where if we're talking about Donald Trump's record, we also have his own audio saying how proud he was to put folks on the Supreme Court to dismantle Roe v. Wade, right? And as much as this felt like Vance's opportunity to clean up his running mate's comments, it was in contradiction. And I keep using that word because it keeps coming up and we have that record. We've seen it multiple times. And I'm not sure that specifically women were buying that in terms of abortion, knowing that he was fully responsible and proud of being able to dismantle Roe v. Wade. And as much as Vance tried to clean up his running mate's record, it's clear we were there, we lived it, we saw it. And I think no amount of gaslighting can change that.
We'll have to end it there. Thank you so much for joining us for Civic Media's coverage of the vice presidential debate. For myself and everyone at Civic Media, thank you for listening and good night.
The Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252 DR Oshkosh, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.